But that eludes her as well. Paris sits. She has to. She doesn't think she can stand at this moment. She waits for the coffee to brew and thinks that when it's ready, she is going to have a cup. And then perhaps a cigarette. And then she is going to go to the living room to call Colette in Lyon. See if her old friend can arrange her a trip to Kabul. But for the moment Paris sits, she shuts her eyes as the coffee maker begins to gurgle. And she finds behind her eyelids hills that stand soft and a sky that stands high and blue and the sun setting behind a windmill. And always, always, hazy strings of mountains that fall and fall away on the horizon.
Chapter 7. Summer 2009.
Your father is a great man. Adele looked up.
It was the teacher, Manalai, who had leaned in and whispered this in his ear. A plump middle-aged woman, wearing a violet beaded shawl around her shoulders, she smiled at him now with her eyes shut.
And you are a lucky boy.
I know, he whispered back.
Good, she mouthed.
They were standing on the front steps of the town's new school for girls, a rectangular light green building with a flat roof and wide windows. As Adele's father, his Baba John, delivered a brief prayer followed by an animated speech. Gathered before them in the blazing midday heat was a large crowd of squinting children, parents and elders, roughly 100 or so locals from the small town of Shatbagh now, New Shatbagh.
"Afghanistan is mother to us all," Adele's father said, one thick index finger raised skyward.
The son cut the band of his agate ring.
"But she is an ailing mother, and she has suffered for a long time. Now it is true a mother needs her sons in order to recover. Yes, but she needs her daughters too, as much, if not more."
This drew loud applause and several calls and hoots of approval. Adele scanned the faces in the crowd. They were rapt as they looked up at his father. Baba John, with his black bushy eyebrows and full beard, standing tall and strong and wide above them, his shoulders nearly broad enough to fill the entryway to the school behind him. His father continued, and Adele's eyes connected with Kabir, one of Baba John's two bodyguards, standing impassively on the other side of Baba John, Kalashnikov in hand. Adele could see the crowd reflected in Kabir's dark lens aviator glasses. Kabir was short, thin, almost frail, and wore suits with flashy colors, lavender, turquoise, orange. But Baba John said he was a hawk, and that underestimating him was a mistake you made at your own peril.
"So I say this to you, young daughters of Afghanistan,"
Baba John concluded, his long, thick arms outstretched in an open gesture of welcome.
"You have a solemn duty now, to learn, to apply yourself, to excel at your studies, to make proud not only your own fathers and mothers, but the mother who is coming to us all. Her future is in your hands, not mine. I ask that you not think of this school as a gift from me to you. It is merely a building that houses the true gift inside, and that is you. You are the gift, young sisters. Not only to me and to the community of Shatbagh now, but most importantly, to Afghanistan herself. God bless you."
More applause broke out. Several people shouted,
"God bless you, Commander Sahib."
Baba John raised a fist, grinning broadly. Adele's eyes nearly watered with pride. The teacher, Malai, handed Baba John a pair of scissors. A red ribbon had been tied across the entryway to the classroom. The crowd inched closer to get a better view, and Kabir motioned a few people back, shoved a couple of them in the chest. Hands rose from the crowd, holding cell phones to video the ribbon cutting. Baba John took the scissors, paused, turned to Adele, and said, "Here, son, you do the honors." He handed the scissors to Adele. Adele blinked. "Me? Go ahead," Baba John said, dropping him a wink. Adele cut the ribbon. Long applause broke out. Adele heard the clicking of a few cameras, voices crying out, "Hello, Akbar!" Baba John then stood at the doorway as the students made a queue and entered the classroom one by one. They were young girls, aged between 8 and 15, all of them wearing white scarves and the pinstriped uniforms of black and gray that Baba John had given them. Adele watched as each student shyly introduced herself to Baba John on her way in. Baba John smiled warmly, patted their heads, and offered an encouraging word or two.
"I wish you success, Bibi Maryam. Study hard, Bibi Humaira. Make us proud, Bibi Elham."
Later, by the Black Land Cruiser, Adele stood by his father, sweating now in the heat, and watched him shake hands with the locals. Baba John fingered a prayer bead in his free hand and listened patiently, leaning in a bit, his brow furrowed, nodding, attentive to each person as he or she came to say thanks, offer prayers, pay respects, many of them taking the opportunity to ask for a favor. A mother whose sick child needed to see a surgeon in Kabul, a man in need of a loan to start a shoe repair shop, a mechanic asking for a new set of tools.
"Commander Sahib, if you could find it in your heart, I have nowhere else to turn. Commander Sahib!"
Adele had never heard anyone outside the immediate family address Baba John by anything other than Commander Sahib. Even though the Russians were long gone now, and Baba John hadn't fired a gun in a decade or more. Back in the house, there were framed pictures of Baba John's jihadi days all around the living room. Adele had committed to memory each of the pictures, his father leaning against the fender of a dusty old jeep, squatting on the turret of a charred tank, posing proudly with his men, a munition belt strapped across his chest, beside the helicopter they had shot down. Here was one where he was wearing a vest and a bandolier, brow pressed to the desert floor in prayer. He was much skinnier in those days, Adele's father. And always in these pictures, there was nothing behind him but mountains and sand. Baba John had been shot twice by the Russians during battle. He had shown Adele his wounds, one just under his left ribcage. He said that one had cost him his spleen, and one about the thumb's length away from his belly button. He said he was lucky, everything considered. He had friends who had lost arms, legs, eyes, friends whose faces had burned. They had done it for their country, Baba John said, and they had done it for God. This was what jihad was all about, he said. Sacrifice. You sacrificed your limbs, your sight, your life even, and you did it gladly. Jihad also earned you certain rights and privileges, he said, because God sees to it that those who sacrifice the most justly reap the rewards as well. Both in this life and the next, Baba John said, pointing his thick finger first down, then up. Looking at the pictures, Adele wished he had been around to fight jihad alongside his father in those more adventurous days. He liked to picture himself and Baba John shooting at Russian helicopters together, blowing up tanks, dodging gunfire, living in mountains and sleeping in caves. Father and son, war heroes. There was also a large framed photo of Babajan smiling alongside President Karzai at ARG, the presidential palace in Kabul. This one was more recent, taken in the course of a small ceremony during which Babajan had been handed an award for his humanitarian work in Shat Baganau. It was an award that Babajan had more than earned. The new school for girls was merely his latest project. Adel knew that women in town used to die regularly giving birth. But they didn't anymore, because his father had opened a large clinic run by two doctors and three midwives whose salaries he paid for out of his own pocket. All the townspeople received free care at the clinic. No child in Shat Baganau went unimmunized. Babajan had dispatched teams to locate water points all over town and dig wells. It was Babajan who had helped finally bring full-time electricity to Shat Baganau. At least a dozen businesses had opened thanks to his loans. That, Adele had learned from Kabir, were rarely, if ever, paid back. Adele had meant what he had said to the teacher earlier. He knew he was lucky to be the son of such a man. Just as the rounds of handshaking were coming to an end, Adele spotted a slight man approaching his father. He wore round, thin-frame spectacles and a short gray beard and had little teeth like the heads of burned matches. Trailing him was a boy roughly Adele's own age. The boy's big toes poked through matching holes in his sneakers. His hair sat on his head as a matted, unmoving mess. His jeans were stiff with dirt, and they were too short besides. By contrast, his T-shirt hung almost to his knees.
Kabir planted himself between the old man and Babajan.
"I told you already this wasn't a good time," he said.
"I just want to have a brief word with the commander,"
the old man said.
Babajan took Adele by the arm and gently guided him into the back seat of the Land Cruiser.
"Let's go, son. Your mother is waiting for you."
He climbed in beside Adele and shut the door. Inside, as his tinted window rolled up, Adele watched Kabir say something to the old man that Adele couldn't hear.
Then Kabir made his way around the front of the SUV and let himself into the driver's seat, laying his Kalashnikov on the passenger seat before turning the ignition.
"What was that about?"
Adele asked. "Nothing important," Kabir said.
They turned onto the road. Some of the boys who had stood in the crowd gave chase for a short while before the Land Cruiser pulled away. Kabir drove through the main crowded strip that bisected the town of Shat Baganau, honking frequently as he needled the car through traffic. Everyone yielded. Some people waved. Adele watched the crowded sidewalk on either side of him, his gaze settling on and then off familiar sights, the carcasses hanging from hooks in butcher shops, the blacksmiths working their wooden wheel, hand-pumping their bellows, the fruit merchants fanning flies from their grapes and cherries, the sidewalk barber on the wicker chair stropping his razor. They passed tea shops, kebab houses, an auto repair shop, a mosque, before Kabir veered the car through the town's big public square, at the center of which stood a blue fountain and a 9-foot-tall blackstone mujahid. Looking east, turban gracefully wrapped atop his head, an RPG launcher on his shoulder. Babajan had personally commissioned a sculptor from Kabul to build the statue. North of the strip were a few blocks of residential area, mostly composed of narrow, unpaved streets and small, flat-roofed little houses painted white or yellow or blue. Satellite dishes sat on the roofs of a few, Afghan flags draped on the number of windows. Babajan had told Adele that most of the homes and businesses in Shat Baganau had been built in the last 15 years or so. He'd had a hand in the construction of many of them. Most people who lived here considered him the founder of Shadbagh-Now, and Adel knew that the town elders had offered to name the town after Babajan, but he had declined the honor. From there, the main road ran north for 2 miles before it connected with Shadbagh-Kurna, old Shadbagh. Adel had never seen the village as it had once looked decades ago. By the time Babajan had moved him and his mother from Kabul to Shadbagh, the village had all but vanished. All the homes were gone. The only surviving relic of the past was a decaying windmill. At Shadbagh-Kurna, Khabir veered left from the main road onto a wide, quarter-mile-long, unpaved track that connected the main road to the thick, 12-foot-high walls of the compound where Adel lived with his parents, the only standing structure now in Shadbagh-Kurna, discounting the windmill. Adel could see the white walls now as the SUV jostled and bounced on the track. Coils of barbed wire ran along the top of the walls. A uniformed guard, who always stood watch at the main gate to the compound, saluted and opened the gate. Khabir drove the SUV through the walls and up the graveled path toward the house. The house stood 3 stories high and was painted bright pink and turquoise green. It has soaring columns and pointed eaves and mirrored skyscraper glass that sparkled in the sun. It had parapets, a veranda with sparkling mosaics, and wide balconies with curved wrought iron railings. Inside, they had 9 bedrooms and 7 bathrooms. And sometimes, when Adel and Babajan played hide-and-seek, Adel wandered around for an hour or more before he found his father. All the counters in the bathrooms and kitchen had been made of granite and lime marble. Lately, to Adele's delight, Babajan had been talking about building a swimming pool in the basement. Khabir pulled into the circular driveway outside the tall front gates of the house. He killed the engine. "Why don't you give us a minute?" Babajan said. Khabir nodded and exited the car. Adel watched him walk up the marble steps to the gates and ring. It was Azmarai, the other bodyguard, a short, stocky, gruff fellow, who opened the gate. The 2 men said a few words, then lingered on the steps, lighting a cigarette each. "Do you really have to go?" Adel said. His father was leaving for the south in the morning to oversee his fields of cotton in Helmand and to meet with workers at the cotton factory he had built there. He would be gone for 2 weeks. A span of time that, to Adel, seemed interminable. Babajan turned his gaze to him. He dwarfed Adel, taking more than half the back seat. "Wish I didn't, son." Adel nodded. "I was proud today. I was proud of you." Babajan lowered the weight of his big hand on Adele's knee. "Thank you, Adel. I appreciate that. But I take you to these things so you learn, so you understand that it's important for the fortunate, for people like us, to live up to their responsibilities."
"I wish you didn't have to leave all the time."
"Me too, son. Me too. But I'm not leaving till tomorrow. I'll be home later in the evening."
Adel nodded, casting his gaze down at his hands.
"Look," his father said in a soft voice, "the people in this town, they need me, Adel. They need my help to have a home and find work and make a livelihood. Kabul has its own problems. It can't help them, so if I don't, no one else will. Then these people would suffer."
"I know that," Adel muttered.
Babajan squeezed his knee gently. "You miss Kabul, I know, and your friends. It's been a hard adjustment here for both you and your mother.
And I know that I'm always off traveling and going to meetings and that a lot of people have demands on my time. But look at me, son.
Adele raised his eyes to meet Babacan's. They shone at him kindly from beneath the canopy of his bushy eyebrows.
No one on this earth matters to me more than you, Adele. You are my son. I would gladly give up all of this for you. I would give up my life for you, son.
Adele nodded, his eyes watering a little. Sometimes when Babacan spoke like this, Adele felt his heart swell and swell until he found it hard to draw a breath.
Do you understand me?
Yes, Babacan.
Do you believe me?
I do.
Good. Then give your father a kiss.
Adele threw his arms around Babacan's neck, and his father held him tightly and patiently. Adele remembered when he was little, when he would tap his father on the shoulder in the middle of the night, still shaking from a nightmare, and his father would push back his blanket and let him climb into bed, folding him in and kissing the crown of his head until Adele stopped shivering and slipped back into sleep.
Maybe I'll bring you something from Helmand,
Babacan said.
You don't have to,
Adele said, his voice muffled. He already had more toys than he knew what to do with, and there wasn't a toy on earth that would make up for his father's absence. Late that day, Adele perched mid-stairway and spied on the scene unfolding below him. The doorbell had rung, and Kabir had answered. Now Kabir was leaning against the doorframe with his arms crossed, blocking the entrance, as he spoke to the person on the other side. It was the old man from earlier at the school Adele saw, the bespectacled man with the burnt match teeth. The boy with the holes in his shoes was there too, standing beside him. The old man said,
"Where has he gone to?"
Kabir said,
"Business, in the south."
"I heard he was leaving tomorrow."
Kabir shrugged.
"How long will he be gone?"
2, maybe 3 months, who is to say?
"That's not what I heard."
"Now you are testing my patience, old man,"
Kabir said, uncrossing his arms.
"I will wait for him."
"Not here, you won't."
"Over by the road, I meant."
Kabir shifted impatiently on his feet. "Set yourself," he said. "But the commander is a busy man, no telling when he will be back."
The old man nodded and backed away, the boy following him. Kabir shut the door. Adele pulled the curtain in the family room and out the window, watched the old man and the boy walking up the unpaved road that connected the compound to the main road.
"You lied to him," Adele said.
"It's part of what I'm paid to do. Protect your father from buzzards."
"What does he want anyway? A job?"
"Something like that."
Kabir moved to the couch and removed his shoes. He looked up at Adele and gave him a wink. Adele liked Kabir, far more than Asmarai, who was unpleasant and rarely said a word to him. Kabir played cards with Adele and invited him to watch DVDs together. Kabir loved movies.
He owned a collection that he had bought on the black market and watched 10 to 12 movies a week.
Iranian, French, American, of course, Bollywood. He didn't care. And sometimes, if Adele's mother was in another room and Adele promised not to tell his father, Kabir emptied the magazine on his Kalashnikov and let Adele hold it, like a mujahid. Now the Kalashnikov sat propped against the wall by the front door. Kabir lay down on the couch and propped his feet up on the arm. He started flipping through a newspaper.
"They looked harmless enough,"
Adele said, releasing the curtain and turning to Kabir. He could see the bodyguard's forehead over the top of the newspaper.
Maybe I should have asked them in for tea, then.
Kabir murmured.
Offer them some cake, too.
Don't make fun.
They all look harmless.
Is Babajan going to help them?
Probably. Kabir sighed. Your father is a river to his people.
He lowered the paper and grinned.
What's that from? Come on, Adele. We saw last month.
Adele shrugged. He started heading upstairs.
Lawrence!
Kabir called from the couch.
Lawrence of Arabia! Anthony Quinn!
And then, just as Adele had reached the top of the stairs.
They're buzzard, Adele. Don't fall for their act. They would pick your father clean if they could.
One morning, a couple of days after his father left for Helmand, Adele went up to his parents' bedroom. The music from the other side of the door was loud and thumping. He let himself in and found his mother in shorts and t-shirt in front of the giant flat-screen TV, mimicking the moves of a trio of sweaty blonde women, a series of leaps and squats and lunges and planks. She spotted him in the big mirror of her dresser. "Want to join me?" she panted over the loud music. "I will just sit here," he said. He slid down to the carpeted floor and watched his mother, whose name was Aria, leapfrog her way across the room and back. Adele's mother had delicate hands and feet, a small upturned nose, and a pretty face like an actress from one of Kabir's Bollywood films. She was lean, agile, and young. She had been only 14 when she had married Babajan. Adele had another older mother too, and three older half-brothers, but Babajan had put them up in the east, in Jalalabad, and Adele saw them only once a month or so when Babajan took him there to visit. Unlike his mother and stepmother, who disliked each other, Adele and his half-brothers got along fine. When he visited them in Jalalabad, they took him with them to parks, to bazaars, to cinema, to buskashi tournaments. They played Resident Evil with him and shot the zombies in Call of Duty with him, and they always picked him on their team during neighborhood soccer matches. Adele wished so badly that they lived here, near him. Adele watched his mother lie on her back and raise her straightened legs off the floor and lower them down again, a blue plastic ball tucked between her bare ankles. The truth was, the boredom here in Schottbach was crushing Adele. He hadn't made a single friend in the 2 years they had lived here. He could not bike into town, certainly not on his own, not with the rash of kidnappings everywhere in the region, though he did sneak out now and then briefly, always staying within the perimeter of the compound. He had no classmates because Babajan wouldn't let him attend the local school. For security reasons, he said. So a tutor came to the house every morning for lessons. Mostly, Adele passed the time reading or kicking the soccer ball around on his own or watching movies with Kabir, often the same ones over and over. He wandered listlessly around the wide, high-ceiling hallways of their massive home, through all the big empty rooms, or else he sat looking out the window of his bedroom upstairs. He lived in a mansion, but in a shrunken world. Some days he was so bored, he wanted to chew wood. He knew that his mother, too, was terribly lonely here. She tried to fill her days with routines. Exercise in the morning, shower, then breakfast, then reading, gardening, then Indian soaps on TV in the afternoon. When Babajan was away, which was often, she always wore gray sweats and sneakers around the house, her face unmade, her hair pinned in a bun at the back of her neck. She rarely even opened the jewelry box where she kept all the rings and necklaces and earrings that Babajan brought her from Dubai. She spent hours sometimes talking to her family down in Kabul. only when her sister and parents visited for a few days, once every 2 or 3 months, did Adele see his mother come alive. She wore a long print dress and high-heeled shoes. She put on her makeup. Her eyes shone, and her laughter could be heard around the house. And it was then that Adele would catch a glimpse of the person that perhaps she had been before. When Baba John was away, Adele and his mother tried to be each other's reprieve. They pushed pieces of jigsaw puzzles around and played golf and tennis on Adele's Wii. But Adele's favorite pastime with his mother was building toothpick houses. His mother would draw a 3D blueprint of the house on a sheet of paper, complete with front porch, gabled roof, and with staircases inside and walls separating the different rooms. They would build the foundation first, then the interior walls and stairs, killing hours carefully applying glue to toothpicks, setting sections to dry. Adele's mother said when she was younger, before she had married Adele's father, she had dreamed of becoming an architect. It was while they were building a skyscraper once that she had told Adele the story of how she and Baba John had married.
"He was actually supposed to marry my older sister," she said.
"Aunt Nargis?"
"Yes. This was in Kabul. He saw her on the street one day, and that was it. He had to marry her. He showed up at our house the next day, him and 5 of his men. They more or less invited themselves in. They were all wearing boots." She shook her head and laughed like it was a funny thing Baba John had done. But she didn't laugh the way she ordinarily did when she found something funny. "You should have seen the expression on your grandparents."
They sat in the living room, Baba John, his men, and her parents. She was in the kitchen making tea while they talked. There was a problem, she said, because her sister, Nargis, was already engaged, promised to a cousin who lived in Amsterdam and was studying engineering. How were they supposed to break off the engagement, her parents were asking.
"And then I come in carrying a platter of tea and sweets. I fill their cups and put the food on their table. And your father sees me, and as I turn to go, your father, he says, 'Maybe you're right, sir. It's not fair to break off an engagement. But if you tell me this one is taken too, then I'm afraid I may have no choice but to think you don't care for me.' Then he laughs, and that was how we got married."
She lifted a tube of glue.
"Did you like him?"
She shrugged a little.
"Truth be told, I was more frightened than anything else." "But you like him now, right? You love him?"
"Of course I do," Adele's mom said.
"What a question. You don't regret marrying him?"
She put down the glue and waited a few seconds before answering.
"Look at our lives, Adele,"
she said slowly.
"Look around you. What's to regret?"
She smiled and pulled gently on the lobe of his ear.
"Besides, then I wouldn't have had you."
Adele's mother turned off the TV now and sat on the floor, panting, drawing sweat off her neck with the towel.
"Why don't you do something on your own this morning?"
she said, stretching her back.
"I'm going to shower and eat, and I was thinking of calling your grandparents. Haven't spoken to them for a couple of days."
Adele sighed and rose to his feet. In his room, on a lower floor, and in a different wing of the house, he fetched a soccer ball and put on the Zidane jersey Baba John had given him for his last birthday, his 12th. When he made his way downstairs, he found Kabir napping, a newspaper spread on his chest like a quilt. He grabbed a can of apple juice from the fridge and let himself out. Adele walked to the gravel path toward the main entrance to the compound. The stall where the armed guard stood watch was empty. Adele knew the timing of guard's rounds. He carefully opened the gate and stepped out, closed the gate behind him. Almost immediately, he had the impression that he could breathe better on this side of the wall. Some days, the compound felt far too much like a prison. He walked in a wide shadow of the wall toward the back of the compound, away from the main road. Back there behind the compound were Baba John's orchards, of which he was very proud. Several acres of long parallel rows of pear trees and apple trees, apricots, cherries, figs, and loquats too. When Adel took long walks with his father in these orchards, Baba John would lift him high up on his shoulders, and Adel would pluck them a ripe pair of apples. Between the compound and the orchards was a clearing, mostly empty, save for a shed where the gardeners stored their tools. The only other thing there was the flat stump of what had once been, by the looks of it, a giant old tree. Baba John had once counted its rings with Adel and concluded that the tree had likely seen Genghis Khan's army march past. He said with a rueful shake of his head that whoever had cut it down had been nothing but a fool. It was a hot day, the sun glaring in the sky as unblemished blue as the skies in the crayon pictures Adel used to draw when he was little. He put down the can of apple juice on the tree stump and practiced juggling his ball. His personal best was 68 touches without the ball hitting the ground. He had set that record in the spring, and now it was midsummer, and he was still trying to best it. Adel had reached 28 when he became aware that someone was watching him. It was the boy, the one with the old man who had tried to approach Baba John at the school's opening ceremony. He was squatting now in the shade of the brick shed.
"What are you doing here?"
Adel said, trying to bark the words like Kabir did when he spoke to strangers.
"Getting some shade,"
the boy said.
"Don't report me."
"You're not supposed to be here."
"Neither are you."
"What?"
The boy chuckled.
"Never mind."
He stretched his arms wide and rose to his feet. Adel tried to see if his pockets were full. Maybe he had come to steal fruit. The boy walked over to Adel and flipped up the ball with one foot, gave it a pair of quick juggles, and kicked it with his heel to Adel. Adel caught the ball and cradled it under his arm.
"Where your goon had us wait, over by the road, me and my father, there is no shade, and not a damn cloud in the sky."
Adel felt a need to rise to Kabir's defense.
"He is not a goon. Well, he made sure we got an eye full of his Kalashnikov, I can tell you that."
He looked at Adel, a lazy, amused grin on his lips. He dropped a wad of speed at his feet.
"So I see you are a fan of the head butter."
It took Adel a moment to realize who he was referring to.
"You can't judge him by one mistake," he said. "He was the best. He was a wizard in the midfield."
"I've seen better."
"Yeah? Like who?"
"Like Maradona."
"Maradona?"
Adel said, outraged. He'd had this debate before with one of his half-brothers in Jalalabad.
"Maradona was a cheater. Hand of God. Remember?
Everyone cheats and everyone lies."
The boy yawned and started to go. He was about the same height as Adel, maybe a hair taller, and probably just around his age too, Adel thought. But somehow he walked like he was older, without hurry, and with a kind of air, as if he had seen everything there was to see and nothing surprised him.
"My name is Adel. Ghulam."
They shook hands. Ghulam's grip was strong, his palm dry and calloused.
"How old are you anyway?"
Ghulam gave a shrug.
13, I guess. Could be 14 by now."
"You don't know your own birthday?"
Ghulam grinned.
"I bet you know yours. I bet you count down."
"I do not,"
Adel said defensively.
"I mean, I don't count down. I should go. My father's waiting alone." "I thought that was your grandfather." "You thought wrong."
Do you want to play a shootout?
Adele asked.
You mean like a penalty shootout? 5 each. Best of.
Ghulam spat again, squinting toward the road and back at Adele.
Adele noticed that his chin was a bit small for his face and that he had overlapping extra canines in front, one of them chipped badly and rotting. His left eyebrow was split in half by a short, narrow scar. Also, he smelled. But Adele hadn't had a conversation, let alone played a game, with a boy his age in nearly 2 years, discounting the monthly visits to Jalalabad. Adele prepared himself for disappointment. But Ghulam shrugged and said,
"Shit, why not? But I get first dibs on shooting."
For goalposts, they used 2 rocks placed 8 steps apart. Ghulam took his 5 shots, scored 1, off target twice, and Adele easily saved 2. Ghulam's goaltending was even worse than his shooting. Adele managed to score 4, tricking him into leaning in the wrong direction each time, and the 1 shot he missed wasn't even on goal.
"Fucker,"
Ghulam said, bent in half, palms on his kneecaps.
"Rematch?"
Adele tried not to gloat, but it was hard. He was soaring inside. Ghulam agreed, and the result was even more lopsided. He again managed 1 goal, and this time Adele converted all 5 of his attempts.
"That's it. I am winded,"
Ghulam said, throwing up his hands. He trudged over to the tree stump and sat down with a tired groan. Adele cradled the ball and sat next to him.
"These probably aren't helping,"
Ghulam said, fishing a pack of cigarettes from the front pocket of his jeans. He had 1 left. He lit it with a single strike of a match, inhaled it contentedly, and offered it to Adele. Adele was tempted to take it, if only to impress Ghulam. But he passed, worried Kabir or his mother would smell it on him.
"Wise,"
Ghulam said, leaning his head back. They talked idly about soccer for a while, and to Adele's pleasant surprise, Ghulam's knowledge turned out to be solid. They exchanged favorite match and favorite goal stories. They each offered a top 5 players list. Mostly it was the same, except Ghulam's included Ronaldo the Brazilian, and Adele's had Ronaldo the Portuguese. Inevitably, they got around to the 2006 finals and the painful memory for Adele of the headbutting incident. Ghulam said he watched a whole match standing with a crowd outside the window of a TV shop not far from the camp.
"The camp? The one where I grew up, in Pakistan."
He told Adele that this was his first time in Afghanistan. He had lived his whole life in Pakistan, in Jalalzai refugee camp, where he had been born. He said Jalalzai had been like a city, a huge maze of tents and mud huts and homes built from plastic and aluminum siding and a labyrinth of narrow passageways littered with dirt and shit. It was a city in the belly of a yet greater city. He and his brothers, he was the eldest by 3 years, were raised in the camp. He had lived in a small mud house there with his brothers, his mother, his father, whose name was Iqbal, and his paternal grandmother, Parwana. In its alleyways, he and his brothers had learned to walk and talk. They had gone to school there. He had played with sticks and rusty old bicycle wheels on its dirt streets, running around with other refugee kids, until the sun dipped and his grandmother called him home.
"I liked it there," he said. "I had friends. I knew everybody. We were doing all right, too. I have an uncle in America, my father's half-brother, Uncle Abdullah. I've never met him, but he was sending us money every few months. It helped. It helped a lot."
"Why did you leave?"
"Had to. The Pakistanis shut down the camp. They said Afghans belong in Afghanistan. And then my uncle's money stopped coming. So my father said we might as well go home and restart, now that the Taliban had ran to the Pakistani side of the border anyway. He said we were guests in Pakistan who'd outstayed their welcome. I was really depressed. This place..."
He waved his hand.
this is a foreign country to me. And the kids in the camp, the ones who had actually been to Afghanistan, none of them had a good thing to say about it.
Adel wanted to say that he knew how Ghulam felt. He wanted to tell him how much he missed Kabul and his friends and his half-brothers over in Jalalabad. But he had a feeling Ghulam might laugh. Instead, he said, "Well, it is pretty boring around here." Ghulam laughed anyway.
"I don't think that's quite what they meant," he said.
Adel understood vaguely that he had been chastised. Ghulam took a drag and blew out a run of rings. Together, they watched the rings gently float away and disintegrate.
"My father said to me and my brothers," he said, "wait, wait until you breathe the air of Shadbagh, boys, and taste the water. I was born here, my father, raised here too. He said you have never had water this cool and this sweet, boys." He was always talking to us about Shadbagh, which I guess was nothing but a small village back when he lived here. He said there was a kind of grape that you could grow only in Shadbagh and nowhere else in the world. You would think he was describing paradise.
Adel asked him where he was staying now. Ghulam tossed the cigarette butt, looked up at the sky, squinting at the brightness.
"You know the open field over by the windmill?"
"Yes." Adel waited for more, but there was no more.
"You live in a field?"
"For the time being," Ghulam mumbled.
"We got a tent."
"Don't you have a family here?"
"No, they're either dead or gone." "Well, my father does have an uncle in Kabul. Or he did. Who knows if he's still alive. He was my grandmother's brother, worked for a rich family there. But I guess Nabi and my grandmother haven't spoken in decades. 50 years or more, I think. They are strangers, practically. I guess if you really had to, my father would go to him, but he wants to make a go of it on his own here. This is his home."
They spent a few quiet moments sitting on the tree stump, watching the leaves in the orchards shiver in surges of warm wind. Adel thought of Ghulam and his family sleeping nights in a tent, scorpions and snakes crawling in the field all around them. Adel didn't quite know why he ended up telling Ghulam about the reason he and his parents moved here from Kabul. Or rather, he couldn't choose among the reasons. He wasn't sure if he did it to dispel Ghulam's impression that he led a carefree existence simply because he lived in a big house, or as a kind of schoolyard one-upmanship. Maybe a plea for sympathy. Did he do it to narrow the gap between them? He didn't know. Maybe all of these things. Nor did Adel know why it seemed important that Ghulam like him, only that he dimly understood the reason to be more complicated than the mere fact of his frequent loneliness and his desire for a friend. "We moved to Shadbagh because someone tried to kill us in Kabul," he said. "A motorcycle pulled up to the house one day and its rider sprayed our house with bullets. He wasn't caught. But thank God, none of us was hurt."
He didn't know what reaction he had expected, but it did surprise him that Ghulam had none. Still squinting up at the sun, Ghulam said,
"Yeah, I know."
"You know?
Your father picks his nose on people here about it."
Adel watched him crush the empty cigarette box into a ball and stuffed it into the pocket of his jeans.
"He does have his enemies, your father,"
Ghulam sighed. Adel knew this. Babajan had explained to him that some of the people who had fought alongside him against the Soviets in the 1980s had become both powerful and corrupt. They had lost their way, he said. And because he wouldn't join in their criminal schemes, they always tried to undermine him, to pollute his name by spreading false, hurtful rumors about him. This was why Babajan always tried to shield Adel. He didn't allow newspapers in the house, for instance, didn't want Adel watching the news on TV or surfing the internet. Ghulam leaned in and said,
"I also hear he is quite the farmer."
Adel shrugged.
You can see it for yourself. Just a few acres of orchards. Well, and the cotton fields in Helmand too, I guess, for the factory.
Holam searched Adele's eyes as a grin slowly spread across his face, exposing his rotting canine.
Cotton? You're a piece of work. I don't know what to say.
Adele didn't really understand this. He got up and bounced the ball.
You can say rematch. Rematch? Let's go. Only this time I bet you don't score one goal.
Now Adele was the one grinning.
Name your bet. That's easy. The Zidane. And if I win?
No, when I win.
I wear you?
Olam said.
I wouldn't worry about that improbability.
It was a brilliant hustle. Olam dove left and right, saved all of Adele's shots. Taking off the jersey, Adele felt stupid for getting cheated out of what was rightfully his, what was probably his most prized possession. He handed it over. With some alarm, he felt the sting of tears, and he fought them back. At least Ghulam had the tact not to put it on in his presence. As he was leaving, he grinned over his shoulder.
Your father, he is not really gone for 3 months, is he? I play you for it tomorrow,
Adele said.
The jersey. I may have to think about that.
Ghulam headed back toward the main road. Halfway there, he paused, fished a rolled-up cigarette box from his pocket, and hurled it over the wall of Adele's house. Every day for about a week, after his morning lessons, Adele took his ball and left the compound. He was able to time his escapades with the armed guard's schedule of rounds for the first couple of tries. But on the third try, the guard caught him and wouldn't let him leave. Adele went back to the house and returned with an iPod and a watch. From then on, the guard surreptitiously let Adele in and out, provided he ventured no farther than the edge of the orchards. As for Kabir and his mother, they barely noticed his 1 or 2 hour absences. It was one of the advantages of living in a house as big as this. Adele played alone behind the compound, over by the old tree stump in the clearing, each day hoping to see Ghulam sauntering up. He kept an eye on the unpaved path stretching to the main road as he juggled, as he sat on the stump watching a fighter jet streak across the sky, as he listlessly flicked pebbles at nothing. After a while, he picked up his ball and plodded back to the compound. Then one day, Ghulam showed up, carrying a paper bag.
Where have you been? Working,
Ghulam said. He told Adele that he and his father had been hired for a few days to make bricks. Ghulam's job was to mix mortar. He said he lugged pails of water back and forth, dragged bags of masonry cement and builder's sand heavier than himself. He explained to Adele how he mixed mortar in a wheelbarrow, folding the mixture in the water with a hoe, folding it again and again, adding water, then sand, until the batch gained a smooth consistency that didn't crumble. He would then push the wheelbarrow to the brick layers and trot back to start a new batch. He opened his palms and showed Adele his blisters.
Wow,
Adele said. Stupidly, he knew, but he couldn't think of another reply. The closest he had ever come to manual labor was one afternoon 3 years ago, when he had helped the gardener plant a few apple saplings in the backyard of their house in Kabul.
Got you a surprise,
Ghulam said. He reached into the bag and tossed Adele the Zidane jersey.
I don't understand,
Adele said, surprised and cautiously thrilled.
I see some kid in town the other day wearing it,
Ghulam said, asking for the ball with his fingers. Adele kicked it to him, and Ghulam juggled as he told the story.
Can you believe it? I go up to him and say, hey, that's my brother's shirt on you. He gives me a look. To make a long story short, we settle it in an alley. By the end, he's begging me to take the shirt.
He caught the ball mid-air, spat and grinned at Adele.
All right, so maybe I sold it to him a couple of days earlier.
That's not right. If you sold it, it was his.
What? You don't want it now? After everything I went through to get it back for you? It wasn't all one-sided, you know. He landed a few decent punches.
Still, Adele muttered.
Besides, I tricked you in the first place, and I felt bad about it. Now you got your shirt back, and as for me...
He pointed to his feet, and Adele saw a new pair of blue and white sneakers.
Is he all right, the other guy?
Adele asked.
He will live. Now, are we going to debate or are we going to play?
Is your father with you?
Not today. He is at the courthouse in Kabul. Come on, let's go.
They played for a while, kicking the ball back and forth, chasing it around. They went for a walk later, Adele breaking his promise to the guard and leading them into the orchards. They ate loquats of the trees and drank cold Fanta from cans Adele covertly fetched from the kitchen. Soon they began to meet this way almost daily. They played ball, chased each other through the orchards, parallel rows of trees. They chatted about sports and movies, and when they had nothing to say, they looked out on the town of Shadbagonau, the soft hillsides in the distance, and the hazy chain of mountains farther yet. And that was all right, too. Every day now, Adele woke up eager for the sight of Ghulam sneaking up the dirt path, the sound of his loud, confident voice. He was often distracted during his morning lessons, his concentration lapsing as he thought of the games they would play later, the stories they would tell each other. He worried he would lose Ghulam. He worried Ghulam's father, Iqbal, wouldn't find steady work in town or a place to live, and Ghulam would move to another town, another part of the country, and Adele had tried to prepare for this possibility, steel himself against the farewell that would then follow. One day, as they sat on the tree stump, Ghulam said,
"Have you ever been with a girl, Adele?"
"You mean..."
"Yeah."
Adele felt a rush of heat around his ears. He briefly contemplated lying, but he knew Ghulam would see right through him. He mumbled,
"You have?"
Ghulam lit a cigarette and offered one to Adele. This time Adele took it. After glancing over his shoulder to make sure the guard wasn't peeking around the corner or that Kabir hadn't decided to step out, he took a drag and launched immediately into a protracted coughing fit that had Ghulam smirking and pounding him on the back.
"So have you or not?"
Adele wheezed, eyes tearing.
"Friend of mine back at the camp,"
Ghulam said in a conspiratorial tone.
"He was older. He took me to the whorehouse in Peshawar."
He told the story. The small, filthy room. The orange curtains. The cracked walls. The single light bulb hanging from the ceiling. The rat he had seen dart across the floor. The sound of rickshaws outside. Sputtering up and down the street. Cars rumbling. The young girl on the mattress, finishing a plate of biryani, chewing and looking at him without any expression. How he could tell, even in the dim light, that she had a pretty face and that she was hardly any older than he. How she had scooped the last grains of rice with a folded piece of naan, pushed away the plate, laying down, and wiped her fingers on her trousers as she had pulled them down. Adele listened, fascinated, enraptured. He had never had a friend like this. Ghulam knew more about the world than even Adele's half-brothers, who were several years older than him. And Adele's friends back in Kabul? They were all the sons of technocrats and officials and ministers. They all lived variations of Adele's own life. The glimpses Ghulam had allowed Adele into his life suggested an existence rife with trouble, unpredictability, hardship, but also adventure. A life worlds removed from Adele's own, though it unfolded
practically within spitting distance of him. Listening to Ghulam's stories, Adele's own life sometimes struck him as hopelessly dull.
So did you do it then?
Adele said.
Did you? You know, stick it in her? Now we had a cup of chai and discuss Rumi. What do you think?